From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional, meaning same-sex couples who are legally married will be recognized by the federal government. The court also ruled in a case that basically makes same-sex marriage in California legal. But what about Michigan? In 2004, voters approved a state constitutional amendment banning recognition of same-sex marriage or similar union. What's the future of that amendment? What changes for same-sex couples legally married in another state but living in Michigan? Joining us now to discuss some of those issues are Larry Dubin. He's a professor at University of Detroit Mercy Law School. And Emily Devendorf. She is the managing director of Equality Michigan. Emily, first, there is a great deal of moral outrage among some people about what they feel is a violation of tradition of marriage. I wonder what you might have to say to those people who are concerned that this is a breakdown of tradition and morals, or that they fear discrimination against people who want to speak out or not serve same-sex couples in business as a way to show their disapproval of same-sex marriage or relationships.
Yes, I would say that the moral code of most Michiganders at this point also includes fundamental fairness. The average Michigander considers fundamental fairness to be a value, and within their definition of fundamental fairness is also equality across the board for the LGBT community. So equality regardless of sexual orientation, gender identity, or expression, and that is a part now of Michigan citizens' value system. So the moral outrage that we're hearing is from the outliers, and it isn't something that we should be basing public policy on. It's certainly not something that the Supreme Court should be ruling based on, and I think today was a great assurance that we are starting to make rulings in the way of civil rights based on where the public is and also where our Constitution is, as opposed to where the outliers and the extremists are.
Larry, let's look at some of the legal questions here. For couples who were legally married in Washington, D.C., or one of the dozen or so states which allow same-sex marriage, and now live in Michigan, how will they benefit? Will they benefit from today's ruling?
Well, that's a complex question, and that goes to whether a judgment in a state that permits same-sex marriage will be given full faith and credit in a state that prohibits it. So that's a kind of an unanswered question. If you ask the question, should that be the case, I would say yes. But I think the law has not developed to the point where there's clarity with respect to that issue.
There's some assumption, it seems, that the 1,000 or 1,100 different points in the law that deal with marriage as far as tax breaks and inheritance and all that will be honored by the federal government. Do we know that yet?
Well, I think according to the ruling today, the states that lawfully permit same-sex marriage now constitutionally are mandated to afford those kinds of benefits to the partners of that marriage. That was essentially the ruling in the DOMA case today.
Yes, it sounds like the question is whether those federal rights will be honored in states where there is not marriage equality like Michigan. And the jury is out on that. And it's a good reason for Michigan citizens to lobby their federal legislators and also the Obama administration to create clarification in our procedures and our federal policies regarding marriage recognition and all of the benefits that come with relationship recognition, so that we can make sure that we are in accordance and creating policy in respect to the Supreme Court ruling today that is uniform and understandable across the board.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think political action will become very important on this issue. Because the courts in general, especially at the Supreme Court level, moves in an incremental fashion. I think we could trace civil rights issues involving race, and you can see that before Brown versus Board of Education, there was more than a decade of other cases that didn't quite hit the center of the issue that eventually brought the ultimate issue to the court with Brown. And I think the same thing is happening today. I think we're seeing the door open, And now there will be future litigation that will further broaden and define these various rights that we're talking about.
Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette this afternoon posted on Facebook to his followers, quote, "Today, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that states, not the federal government, retain the constitutional authority to define marriage. Michigan's constitution stands, and the will of the people to define marriage as between one man and one woman endures in the Great Lakes State," unquote. But there's a federal case already pending in Michigan looking at this issue. April DeBoer and her partner Jane Rose are challenging Michigan's ban on same-sex marriage. Now, this challenge originally began as an attempt to get second-parent adoption for the children so that both of the women had parental rights and the children had two parents. But it changed a bit. Judge Bernard Friedman had said he'd wait on the rulings by the U.S. Supreme Court before deciding this case. How might these rulings affect Judge Friedman's decision?
Well, I think that we can't say that the decisions today are squarely on point to the issue that Judge Friedman is dealing with. But what I find interesting is if you look at the DOMA case and you see that it's a 5-4 case, and again, you're looking to see which way Justice Kennedy is going to fall on the decision, whether it's going to be the conservative bloc that wins or the more liberal bloc. Kennedy was not only the deciding vote, but he wrote the majority opinion. And there's some very strong language in there written by Justice Kennedy stating that there was no legitimate purpose, essentially, that would justify the discrimination against the litigant in that case who was involved in a same-sex marriage. No legitimate purpose. And his ultimate finding was that it was a violation of the Fifth Amendment. And there's a lot of language in his opinion that I think would give this Michigan case that's now pending the benefit to essentially find the Michigan ban to be unconstitutional.
So we'll see what happens with that. Meanwhile, in the legislature, both in the Michigan House and Senate, there is a question of amending the state constitution to end the ban on same-sex marriage. It would require a 2-thirds majority by the legislature to see that happen. But given the tone and tenor of the legislature, mostly Republican, it doesn't seem that they'd get those 2-thirds majority. So it seems that the only way to get something before the people or to get the amendment changed is to allow petitioning for another vote on the issue as soon as 2016. Emily Diefendorf, you've stated you're involved in organizing for that effort. Are the votes going to be there? It's only been 9 years ago when the voters said marriage is only for one man and one woman.
Yes, I believe the votes absolutely will be there in 2016 for us to repeal that constitutional ban. In just those years since the 2004 ban was put into place, there has been a complete reversal in terms of the public position on this issue. 59% were in favor of the ban at the time, and at this point, depending on what poll you look at, 56 to 57% are in favor of both repealing the ban and replacing it with full marriage equality for LGBT citizens. So I think that Michigan is ready. What we're lacking right now is Michigan legislative leadership and a Michigan government that wants to stand up for Michigan citizens and represent the values of Michigan citizens and fight for those relationships today. So we do intend to collect the necessary signatures, put those on the ballot, and we do intend to win.
There's been a lot of cheering by members of the LGBT community regarding today's rulings by the Supreme Court, but this seems to be just a first step toward equal rights for the LGBT community. Discrimination in employment, discrimination in housing, discrimination in public accommodations are all still legal in Michigan. How would you describe these decisions in the larger scheme of things? Let's start with you, Larry.
Well, I think that, you know, here again, you're absolutely right. The civil rights law in Michigan, I think, does need to be expanded to include gay people. And that would permit protection from a state statute with respect to employment and other issues that other groups similarly receive the protection against discrimination. This is a process, again, looking at prior Supreme Court cases leading up to today. going back to 1986 and Bowers versus Hartwick, we had the United States Supreme Court upholding Georgia's sodomy law. In 2003, that was reversed in Lawrence versus Texas, recognizing that was unconstitutional. A similar law was unconstitutional. So there is the pathway now, and that's, I think, the significance, really, of today. This is not a terminal point, these cases that were decided today. It's really the opening of the door and the continuation of precedent. And now the important justice on this current court, anyway, is Justice Kennedy. And I think in terms of future elections, I think one of the interesting points is to see the tie-in between politics and judicial decision-making, and that a presidential election is very key to the Supreme Court justices who ultimately will be appointed when there is a vacancy, and that is going to have a big impact on the speed in which I think full civil rights are granted to gay people.
Larry Dubin, he's a professor at the University of Detroit Mercy Law School. Emily Devendorf, she is the managing director of Equality Michigan. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, we look at energy in Michigan. Today, it's all about coal. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham, filling in for Cynthia Canty. There's a huge disconnect between our use of electricity and the burning of coal. So let me connect the dots for you. The average American's use of electricity in a day equals 20 pounds of coal. That's what you burn on average. And in Michigan, all the coal we use is imported from out of state. Joining us to talk about coal and our dependence on it now and in the future is DTE Energy's Skiles Boyd. Welcome. He's the Vice President of Environmental Management and Resources at DTE. And Tiffany Hartung with the Sierra Club, where she is the organizer for the Moving Beyond Coal campaign. So one of the biggest coal-burning power plants in the nation is here in Michigan. DTE Energy's Monroe Power Plant is the fourth largest coal-fired power plant in the nation, and it's one of a half dozen or so power plants operated by DTE. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So DTE said that for last year, coal made just over 76% of the fuel that it used to create electricity. That's up from the percentage of fuel used in 2005. I think it was 61%, just a little more than 61% then. Other fuels DTE used last year included nuclear, about 15% of your fuel supply, natural gas around 5%, and renewables like wind, solar, and biomass, about 4%. So, Mr. Boyd, you've invested a lot of money in this Monroe power plant for the last few years. I take it DTE plans to stick with coal for a while?
Well, absolutely. Coal is a valuable resource that has really fueled the industrial development in this country. And there were a lot of coal plants built in that time because that was the most economical approach to supplying energy. And so any kind of move away from that will take a little bit of time and will have to be balanced with the increased cost.
Now, you've invested in some equipment to reduce some kinds of air pollution at the Monroe plant. You just lost a court battle with the EPA because basically they say the company dodged upgrading pollution control equipment that the EPA says is required. With all the concerns about pollution from burning coal and greenhouse gas emissions from burning coal, why did this happen?
Well, let me correct a couple of things that you indicated. First of all, we didn't lose a court case. This is basically we won at the local level. It went to the appeals court. The appeals court has really just sent back a very limited decision for the lower court to review. And so that we'll play that through and we're pretty confident we'll win ultimately. The Monroe Power Plant is got the best emission control equipment that you can put on a power plant on two of its units, and the other two are under construction. Our emission reductions system-wide have been about 90% particulate reduction over the last just under four decades since we really started looking hard at those things, of a 75% reduction in sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, which are two other pollutants that we're trying to reduce. The equipment that we're putting on Monroe, once it's fully, it'll be a 95% removal of sulfur dioxide, which was pretty low because we burn very low sulfur coal to start with.
Western coal, I take it.
Western coal primarily. And about 85% reduction in nitrogen oxides.
We should point out that nitrogen oxides are the things that contribute to smog. Sulfur dioxide is the thing that contributes to acid rain. So you've made some improvements at that 40-year-old plant. Tiffany Hartung, do you think the Sierra Club views this court case the same way? And what about these improvements DTE Energy has made at the Monroe plant and its other plants?
Well, so as you mentioned, Michigan and DTE in particular is pretty dependent on coal-fired power plants. And as a nation, we're moving away from that. But right now, DTE's coal-fired power plants lack widely available modern pollution controls. All of DTE's coal plants that were built in the 50s or 60s, and most of the ones that are still in operation today. And we believe it's time to follow the trends that other utilities are taking, utilities in the Midwest, and move towards retiring those and shifting towards cleaner and cheaper renewable energy.
Now, the Sierra Club has been hammering away through campaigns and lawsuits to nudge power companies across the state to move away from coal.
That's right.
If coal is a domestic fuel, it's plentiful, it's relatively cheap, why not take advantage of it?
As you mentioned, coal is a domestic fuel. However, it's not Michigan domestic fuel. And as you mentioned earlier, Michigan imports all of our coal from out of state. We send $1.7 billion annually out of state, a lot to out west, Powder River Coal, Wyoming, to Appalachia. And that's an unnecessary fuel cost that we have. And Michigan families are paying for that, both with our pocketbooks and the added cost of bringing in a more increasingly expensive fuel from out of state, but also with our health. There's a lot of issues around the pollution and health effects from coal-fired power plants.
Now, last year, the environmental community lost a pretty significant battle when voters turned down a constitutional amendment that would require a greater mandate for renewable energy, the so-called 25 by 25 plan. What do you think happened there?
Sure. So there was what we saw last year was sort of a lot of constitutional amendment proposals that sort of created a sort of an anti-constitutional amendment wave that came through. But what I would say about that is that election day polling showed that 73% across the board bipartisan Michigan voters support expanding renewable energy in Michigan beyond the current energy law. So there is a lot of public support in Michigan. Voters see the benefits of renewable energy, of cleaner air and creating a stronger clean energy economy here in Michigan.
Skiles Boyd, DTE Energy recently has filed a plan with the Michigan Public Service Commission to lower renewable energy surcharges to residential customers. It'll drop from $3 a month to about 43 cents. That'll amount to about $90 million in savings for consumers. I'm sure your customers will appreciate a couple of bucks they'll save each month, but I'm wondering, why didn't you continue the surcharge and actually expand your renewable portfolio?
Well, we balance a lot of different things as we make our energy generation decisions. And so we have a lot of our industrial customers are competing worldwide, and so they need very reasonable rates. We have a lot of customers, you know, residential customers that are still struggling following the downturn in the economy. So we have to balance all of those things. We are meeting the standard going forward of the 10% renewables by 2015. What we found is it's less expensive to do that than what was originally assumed and when that was developed. So we're very supportive of moving forward with additional renewables, but that's not a decision that we get to make all by ourselves. We're a regulated company, and that's with the Public Service Commission and with the government of the state of Michigan. And so, you know, that was we struggled a little bit last year as we had the ballot proposal because we're in favor of additional renewables. We just a constitutional that locks in a certain amount by a certain date is probably not the right approach. The right approach is to evaluate as you need additional energy, or as you're making decisions to transfer from coal or from other sources to renewables, you know, that's an overall decision you need to make with the Public Service Commission, with our stakeholders.
So you can't just add more renewable energy into the mix right now without the Public Service Commission's blessings, or what are you saying?
Not and have the company recover its investment. So, I mean, you know, that we are a regulated company. So anytime you need new generation, you go to the Public Service Commission and you say, we need new generation, or we want to transfer this, and this is what we're going to put into our rates for our customer. So, and they have a process to approve or reject that.
But you already had $3 a month and you could have used it to do that, right? I mean, you already had the funding through the surcharge, and now you're proposing giving about $2.57 back instead of using it.
Right. Well, we feel that's the right approach to do these things as we make these decisions, is to allow, you know, make sure that all of our stakeholders are aware of that, and we can make a decision with the Public Service Commission to do something different. But we owe that to our customers because they're pushing hard for lower rates.
So what is DTE Energy doing about greenhouse gas emissions?
We've held our greenhouse gas emissions pretty flat from about 1990 to about 2005, 2006. Since that time, we've reduced it by about 12%. The president has talked about a 17% reduction by 2020, and we think we'll probably be around that range with the increased renewables that are being built and with other things that will go on as far as, you know, less generation with coal.
Ms. Hartung, what does the Sierra Club think about the efforts of DTE, Consumers Energy, and the other power generating companies in Michigan on addressing climate change?
Sure. We think DTE and our Michigan utilities are dragging their feet. Greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired power plants are about 80% of carbon emissions in the U.S. and the largest carbon source in the energy sector. Since 2010, about 50,000 megawatts of existing coal-fired generation in the U.S. has been announced to retire, and that includes neighboring states like Ohio and Illinois in the Midwest. Unfortunately, we're worried that Michigan's going to get left behind.
Now, Mr. Boyd just made the point that he's trying to keep energy costs low for his consumers, residential and commercial. If we start talking about investing in renewables, we're talking about an increased capital cost because you have to build these wind turbines. You have to build solar panel arrays. How many consumers are going to be willing to pay a little more for that?
So, and I'd actually also like to speak to the point you were talking about, lowering DTE announcing this week, lowering the renewable energy surcharge. Sierra Club applauds that the surcharge is being lowered, but we do think that is long overdue. With the renewable energy plan filing and DTE announcing that they're lowering their surcharge, DTE was acknowledging that the cost of renewables are cheaper and cost competitive, and the cost of associated with coal are going up, and it's a risk for ratepayers and the company alike. And so moving towards more clean energy and energy efficiency to sort of keep those environmental liabilities to a minimum for both ratepayers and the company and shareholders.
Let me make perfectly clear, as a company, we're very supportive of moving towards renewables. But we always have to balance the pace of change with our customers' ability to absorb that change. And we've talked about renewable prices going down. That's absolutely true. It's still more expensive, any new generation. You know, we want to make transition. We think diversity of fuel is really the best approach. Because, you know, natural gas prices move around, coal has its drawbacks, but renewables cost and they are very intermittent. So we don't have storage really to get past a certain level of renewables. But we want to move in that direction and have a very diversified fuel base.
I was going to say it's happening in states around us, as Ms. Hartung said. I mean, I'm from Illinois. It's seen a substantial increase. I see a lot in Indiana. There's a huge amount of wind turbine power in Minnesota and Iowa, as she mentioned. Here we are, a Great Lakes state. We don't have quite the wind that Minnesota does, but we've got pretty good ratings. It seems like a no-brainer because once the tower's up, from then on, anything that's generated is pretty much free except for the transmission lines.
Right. And it's being built. And, you know, we've invested – 520 million in 11 and 2011, 2012, another 200 million this year to build new wind. In addition to that, we're signing contracts with others. There are other states that it's better than Michigan. One of the things that we don't have in Michigan is an increasing demand for electricity, a significant increasing demand. That makes it a lot easier to build new generation. Any kind of generation is whenever you have an increasing demand. Right now, ours is pretty flat. And a lot of that is a good thing because of energy efficiency that we've implemented in the state. So we need to keep doing that. And as we need to add new generation, we need to look at those things. And I'm totally confident that wind will play in well, as will less emitting natural gas.
So until there's an increased demand, you're not going to be taking older, dirtier power plants offline to replace it with renewable?
We will be taking some offline, as those are the right decision to make.
I wanted to ask you both, are we going to move away from coal faster than we have been, or are we going to find a way to burn it more cleanly and sequester the carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases? What's the Sierra Club think about what's going to happen in the next 10 to 20 years?
Sure. As Sierra Club thinks nationally, that is definitely the trend, and we're seeing that already, as I mentioned. For Michigan, I think that depends on DTE's choices, DTE being the largest utility, as well as Consumers Energy and co-ops like Wolverine. DTE has a very big financial interest in maintaining status quo. In addition to the regulated power supplier entity that DTE has, it also has some unregulated entities that keep Michigan dependent on coal. DTE is among the top producers of three North American coal marketers and transporters. Coal is very tied to DTE's bottom line, and I think that will be part of the decision.
Yeah, that's something that was brought up. You guys own a lot of rail cars. You move coal for you and for other companies, right?
No. We own rail cars to bring our coal in. We do ship some other coal through our transshipment facility that was actually built to reduce the cost of generation in Michigan, and they're able to use that facility to transship to other facilities around the area. Most of our non-regulated business is outside of Michigan, so it really has no relationship to the generation here and the use of coal in this state.
Well, it's a subsidiary. It has something to do with your bottom line and then your profit motivations, I would think.
Right, but we're very broad there. I mean, we have a number of biomass facilities. We have landfill gas to energy facilities across the country. It's not tied to coal.
All right, one last question. With developed nations moving toward ever larger renewable energy portfolios, even coal-rich nations like Germany are using a lot more solar and some wind. Will the U.S. find itself, will Michigan find itself at a competitive disadvantage in the coming decades if we don't escalate this move towards renewable?
I don't believe it'll find itself at a competitive disadvantage. I mean, we need to move forward with renewables in a way that's right for our customers, right for the residents in Michigan. People talk about, major manufacturing coming to Michigan if we do renewables. That really hasn't played out in other locations. Windmills will be built where there's manufacturing facilities building windmills already.
And we do build them here.
Right. We do build some. But, it's not a major move for jobs.
Ms. Hartung, same question. Are we going to be at a competitive disadvantage if we don't move faster toward renewables?
Absolutely. And we're already seeing that. Michigan is at risk of being left behind as we're coming to meet our 2008 energy law here in a couple of years. The Michigan Public Service Commission produces an annual report on the renewable energy in Michigan and the economic activity. And their report from 2012 showed renewable energy in Michigan generated $1.8 billion in economic activity through last year. So that's something for a state that our economy has seen better days. It's one of the few bright spots in our state's economy, and it's something that we need to support.
We've been speaking with Tiffany Hartung with the Sierra Club and the Moving Beyond Coal campaign, and Skiles Boyd. He's with DTE Energy, the Vice President of Environmental Management and Resources at DTE. Thanks both for coming in.
Thanks.
Thank you.
It's been 3 weeks since a new Whole Foods market opened in Detroit. Coming up, what it's meant for Midtown and the way Detroiters shop for food. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. There's been a lot of buzz about the grocery chain Whole Foods opening a store in Midtown Detroit. Maybe too much buzz. And the idea of Whole Foods, the store nicknamed by some as Whole Paycheck, being the first store in a city hit hard by poverty, seems at best incongruent. Joining us to discuss that is Kame Podokuchi, who is an associate professor of urban planning at Wayne State University, and Mickey Maynard, contributor to Forbes.com and former Detroit reporter for the New York Times. First, let's begin. Kame, I learned Whole Foods work with at least four community-based organizations in Detroit to make sure the people who work at the store actually live in the area and not just a bunch of suburban commuters. That sounds good for Detroit, but how well did they do? How committed are they to maintain that?
So I don't know the details about the outreach that they did in the community to seek workers, but I know there's a lot of interest in the community, especially among activists, that Whole Foods hire local workers, locally based, city-based workers, and especially given that the city is four-fifths African-American, that they hire African-American workers. And just based on my understanding of things, I think they've done a pretty good job. Their manager is African-American, and that's, I think, for community members, a very good sign.
This is the first real supermarket in Detroit in a long time, making the city a so-called food desert until now. So it's getting a lot of attention. But how well is this store going to be serving the people of Detroit?
So first, let me say that I would take issue with your characterization of Whole Foods as the first real supermarket, because while Detroit faces problems in terms of access to healthy foods in certain neighborhoods, Detroit also has very good independent supermarkets. And let me just name a few. The Metro Foodland in Northwest Detroit, Honeybee Market in Southwest Detroit, Mike's Fresh. So there are good independent grocery stores. And there are some chain supermarkets as well that are considered to be second-tier chain supermarkets, but they provide, you know, a limited assortment of good grocery products. Whole Foods has created a lot of buzz, and it would be good for the city to get Whole Foods because it's a sign of a nationally recognized sort of quality-oriented chain being interested in Detroit. And, you know, Detroit is a big city, and Detroiters would like to think that the kinds of supermarkets that are in other big cities, you know, you should be able to find them in Detroit. So I think there's a sense that finally there are chain supermarkets paying attention to Detroit, and I believe this is also a good thing for Whole Foods.
Mickey, I heard an interview on Marketplace with Whole Foods CEO Walter Robb. He indicated they'd been offering workshops for residents to teach them how to manage their food budgets. Is that good PR or a real service to the region's residents?
Well, you have to remember who will probably shop at this Whole Foods, at least at the beginning. It'll be people who live in Midtown Detroit. So you have a large number of professionals. You have people associated with the university. I think probably a lot of their customers have been in a Whole Foods and are familiar with the price base at the market. And that's one thing you have to remember is these stores come in based on zip codes. It's sort of a slang term in the retail industry. They look at where people live that shop at the other stores, and then they try to see, do I have a critical mass of people and could we open a store there? And I'm sure that the same folks who were initially shopping at Whole Foods were shopping in Whole Foods around the Detroit area. As far as teaching people, I honestly have to say despite the wide availability of Whole Foods here in Ann Arbor, I tend to shop at other places. I'm a big believer in farmers markets because I just feel that their prices do tend to be higher, and it's called Whole Paycheck for a reason.
Given the prices at the suburban Whole Foods anyway, how affordable is this food for low-income people who live in the neighborhoods there?
Well, if folks are getting bridge cards, I'm sure that bridge cards are accepted at Whole Foods, so that would be one help. The one thing Detroit doesn't have, in addition to sort of the local chain markets that we're talking about, it doesn't have a lot of farmers markets. It's got the big market at Eastern Market, which is a terrific asset to the city. But if you look at Chicago, where I lived for a while, there are 37 farmers markets, one somewhere every day in the city, and they're in all corners of Chicago. So you don't have the availability of the farmer direct to consumer products.
May I just jump in here very quickly and say, just not even a mile away from the Whole Foods, there's a Wayne State University Farmers Market that I run through a program that I lead on campus called Seed Wayne. The Wayne State, thank you for allowing me this opportunity to make a shameless plug. The Wayne State University Farmers Market started June 5th, the same day as the opening of Whole Foods, and will run through the end of October every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. And it offers a wide variety of fresh and ready-to-eat products at very affordable prices. And there are 9 other neighborhood farmers markets in Detroit. So we're not quite Chicago, perhaps, but we're getting there.
Let's talk about locally sourced, though, because that's one of the things that some other chains make a big deal of. They feature Michigan products. How likely are we to see inventory sourced from Detroit, the metropolitan region, or from the state?
In fact, I think Whole Foods has done a very good job reaching out to local producers. They held a local fair, a local producer fair, and they have a whole section in their store that is dedicated to local, you know, Detroit-based products. Avalon Bakery, for example, Sweet Potato Sensations, Slow's Jams, I mean, a whole array of products. And in fact, I haven't yet gone to the store because it was crazy when I tried getting in. I heard the very first day the local section was emptied out very quickly. That's a great sign, the support of local producers.
Now, there's another chain coming into Detroit. Meyer Foods is building a store at 8 Mile and Woodward in Detroit to open in late July. Is that any more or less noteworthy than this Whole Foods in Midtown?
I would say what took them so long. I think there are definitely other parts of Detroit that could support a Myers, a Plum Market, a Hiller's, that Bush's, all these local chains that we have in the metropolitan Detroit area. Where were they? Why did it take Whole Foods being first? So as far as Myers is concerned, you have to remember they're going to draw from Ferndale, from Royal Oak.
Right.
They're picking
right
the part of Detroit where they can pull in from the suburbs. So it will help the city, but it will also draw from beyond the border, basically.
I'm wondering what this store, this Whole Foods store, is going to do for Detroit as a whole. I mean, Midtown is actually an up-and-coming area of the city. What about the people in the less well-served areas? You talked about these small markets. Are we going to see other areas served as well as this rather affluent area?
I think Whole Foods has started a little bit of a conversation that will draw interest from other chains. But I also think supermarkets are cautious about where the census statistics are trending. And so they're going to look very carefully at population and income figures before they invest heavily in any particular area. So I think Whole Foods has perhaps opened the door for other chains to start thinking about investments. I mean, I think there's still room for more grocery stores in Detroit, given what's considered to be the outshopping.
Let's talk about, just for a moment, access to the store, because even if you have a Meijer on 8th and Woodward and this Midtown grocery store, Whole Foods, even if you have big chain stores like this opening up, are you going to draw that many people in? Because not everybody has a car. Public transportation is not the best way to get around in Detroit. It seems like access to these stores is going to be limited for many, many folks. Mickey?
If you ever get light rail on Woodward, I think that's the Whole Foods will do fine, because the light rail system that's proposed for the Woodward corridor would go right by the Whole Foods. You're absolutely right. Bus system is not reliable in the city. From some of the neighborhoods, it's a long, long walk to go to Whole Foods.
And it's also an unfortunate reality that people, for example, who are making their big grocery trip, say, for example, bridge card participants, will find a way to catch a ride, maybe with a shared cab or a jitney. And they spend a lot of money on transportation to the supermarket, but they're clearly weighing the costs, you know, the low cost of produce versus the cost and convenience and all that kind of thing. So, yes, transit is a problem in Detroit. But I think people have figured out a way to get to more distant grocery stores, and they would like to have, you know, the same quality closer home.
I want to talk about comfort food issues for a bit, because in other cities I've worked in, St. Louis, Missouri, for example, I have found that you can bring a big grocery store chain into an area, but people are used to their food that they had available to them, whether it was just from a convenience store or a gas station. So it's a lot of boxed items. This idea of fresh produce is foreign. They don't know what to do with it. It seems expensive. With an area with limited access to food, often there are really bad eating habits to go along with that. You want to address that?
Sure. And I think all of us, you know, need to improve our eating. We need to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables than we are. And that is true of Detroit as a whole as well. But I should say, I mean, Whole Foods has come into a well-tilled land. You know, there's been 10 years worth of community grassroots activism in terms of developing gardens, linking young people to gardens. We know that young people will eat the vegetables they grow, working with schools, really talking about talking up nutrition, especially the consumption of fruits and vegetables. So while there's a lot more work to be done, it's not as if, and actually to be fair, Whole Foods has also engaged in courses around nutrition education, sort of buying on a budget and things like that. So I'm optimistic that people are on the right track in terms of eating more fruits and vegetables.
Mickey, we're talking about decades of this going on, though. Are you as optimistic?
Well, one of the things I noticed when I was in Whole Foods in New Orleans is that it's definitely tailored for local eating habits. There's a lot of seafood. There's ribs for barbecue. There's the kind of greens and other things that people in New Orleans cook. So I think as Whole Foods gets a feel for what Detroiters cook at home, that it probably will adjust. The only thing I will say is that Whole Foods tends to focus a lot on the prepared meals. So the salmon, the quinoa salad, all the things you find in the big case. And honestly, I think that's going to be out of the reach for a lot of people in terms of price. Now, obviously, if you're, you know, well-paid professor or administrator at Wayne, or you own an entrepreneurial company, you're not worried about the price of grilled salmon. But if you walk in and you've never bought grilled salmon for $19 a pound, you're going to say, I just can't afford to eat here. I can't afford this kind of food. So I think it's incumbent upon them to show Detroiters that it's sensitive to what people cook at home and have what they're used to buying.
Let's step back for a second. What's the store going to do for Detroit as a whole? I mean, you know, like we said, Midtown's an up-and-coming area. What about the rest of the city? Is this a statement of any kind? Is this saying, okay, now is the time we can invest in Detroit and feel good about it?
One of the things I've noticed in other cities where there are Whole Foods, so Reno, Nevada, Chicago, D.C., New Orleans, is that when people move to the city, they actually look around to see where there's a Whole Foods. So if you think about Washington, D.C., and you look at real estate ads, it'll say, two blocks from the Whole Foods. Or if you go to Reno, South Reno has done pretty – South Reno was already a vibrant part of the area, but that's where the Whole Foods is. That may be where people move because they can go shopping there. Same with Chicago. There's a Whole Foods in the South Loop part of Chicago, which needed obviously a grocery store because of all those brand new condos and high-rise apartments. You need something to keep people considering that part of town. So I think the fact that there's a Whole Foods in Detroit, as people are saying, gosh, should I take this opportunity? They can look and say, well, there's a Whole Foods. And honestly, it is a determining factor of a tiny fraction, but for some people, it might convince them it's okay to live in Detroit.
That's amazing. Just the idea that the right kind of grocery store in the right place can help development of a city.
It isn't – I'm not going to say this is going to get Detroit a $100 million investment.
Right.
But there might be somebody on the bubble between living in Dearborn or Farmington and living downtown. And if they see they can shop, they will make that call.
I agree that I think Whole Foods will make – investors a little more comfortable, especially in the Midtown area. But I think Whole Foods has also made a very deliberate strategy opening the store where they did, because the actual median income of the surrounding area is lower than the typical zip code in which Whole Foods might open a store. And what they're doing is they're really focused on the daytime population in the neighborhood rather than just the residents, because that's not enough and professors don't make that much money, at least not I don't. So they are, I think, very focused on the nearby suburbs, people from the nearby suburbs driving in to Midtown to be shopping there. So will Whole Foods attract residents? You know, I think that it would be great, and that's a good question to ask, but I think it'll definitely attract more investment.
One of the examples you mentioned earlier, Avalon Bakery, is one of the suppliers. Avalon Bakery's done a really good job at reaching out to its neighborhood. And I'm wondering if we're ever going to be able to see that from a chain like Whole Foods or Meijer or somebody like that. Or is that something that you just have to be passionate about in a way that a chain cannot be. Mickey?
It's a good focal point for development. And you're closer to the store than I am. So what is it like around that area in terms of storefronts? My impression is that it's pretty filled up.
It is getting there. There are some really good destination restaurants and food outlets. The Yale Midtown is definitely a destination for food and other types of retail investment.
What about this outreach, though, that, like I said, Avalon Bakery really has gone out of its way to include the neighborhood?
Right. Avalon has been actually an economic development force, and that they're part of the Cass Corridor. So I'd love to see Whole Foods play a role in that, but it isn't their primary responsibility.
There is a difference. So Avalon is a very community-minded business, and it was both out of an interest for the larger community as well as its own interest that it worked very hard to, for example, attract other businesses to the Willis Corridor and support other businesses. Whole Foods, even if it wanted to do, I think would be limited in that kind of encouragement of local businesses. But I think Whole Foods' approach is different as well. They're reaching out to the Detroit community as a whole in terms of looking for organizations and initiatives to support. And I think that's a good thing. I think it's raised the bar a little bit in terms of what corporations can do, especially food chains can do to support community-based grassroots efforts.
So last question, what are the measurements of success here? I mean, how and when will we know whether Whole Foods has been a real benefit for Detroit residents?
Well, first of all, it has to stay open. So we need to see some longevity on Whole Foods' part.
Because Rob says he's got a 25-year lease.
Just having a 25-year lease doesn't guarantee. I've been to store openings of other chains in Detroit that disappeared. So I would just like to make sure they're there 5 years from now. So that's the first thing. Do they stick it out? And then the immediate area, does it draw more businesses, more foot traffic to that part of Detroit? And then who else do we see? We know Myers is coming. Will we see others come in? And honestly, business leaders talk to each other. So folks will be talking to the Whole Foods general manager and saying, what has your experience been with the city? How are you doing on permitting? Do you feel safe? And they can be a source of information for others who are coming into the city.
Kami, what are the measurements we should be looking at?
We know that Whole Foods has a reputation for being expensive and being elitist. So I'd be looking at that. They have talked about competitive pricing, and I know Walter Robb is very interested in making sure that the foods are affordable and accessible to Detroit residents. So I would be very interested in looking at prices for, you know, staple products, especially fruits and vegetables. I'd be very interested in seeing the extent to which they stick it out in terms of local city-based hiring and the extent to which, you know, team members move up, for example, to management. I'm also interested in seeing the impact on the grocery sector as a whole as well. I'd be interested in seeing, you know, how Whole Foods supports the grassroots food scene, because there have been sort of somewhat mixed reactions. I'll pay attention to that.
Well, there's what we need to look for. That's Kami Potokuchi, who's Associate Professor of Urban Planning at Wayne State University, and our friend Mickey Maynard. She's a contributor for Forbes.com. Thanks for coming in.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe. Politics is my middle name, Clark. Stateside engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. I'll see you tomorrow.